You got to cure the disease. You got to find a way to motivate people to break free of their cocoon of comfort, bring them in here so they can collectively address these problems. Strength in numbers, ladies and gentlemen, that's what makes this country great. People who believe in something. But how many people have actually read the Constitution? How many people live the Constitution? You can't live a document you're unfamiliar with. And if you don't think the Constitution is important, then you don't deserve the title of American citizen. The Constitution defines who we are as a people. And when you don't know the Constitution, and you don't know where to go when those whom we elect to office to represent us start deviating from the Constitution, when they start implementing Patriot Acts or Patriot Act IIs, when they start detaining American citizens and putting them in military prisons and denying them access to lawyers, when they start invading nations in violation of international law, when they deploy the sons and daughters of our country who honor us by wearing the uniform of the armed services of the United States of America abroad to commit war crimes. Ladies and gentlemen, our men and women are committing war crimes on a daily basis. The occupation of Iraq is in and of itself a war crime. To sit there and to pursue a tribunal to prosecute the former members of the regime of Saddam Hussein at this point in time is a war crime. It's a violation of the Geneva Accord. An occupying power cannot pass and implement laws. That is the responsibility of a sovereign government, and there is no sovereign government. An occupying power cannot sell the economic assets of a nation, and yet we are doing that as we speak. And because the war in Iraq has gone bad for us, other things are happening. Assassinations done in the name of the United States. We are crossing the borders into Syria, into Iran, bringing the war into those countries. This situation is spinning out of control, ladies and gentlemen. We're not going to fix the problem in Iraq. We've lost this war. We cannot win this war. All we can do is mitigate the damage that's been done. And the only way we can mitigate that is to get the troops out now. There's no reason or justification for continued military presence in Iraq. But even when the troops come home, if we don't do something to address the conditions which got those troops to deploy to begin with, all we're going to do is buy time until the next country we invade. So what do we do? That's the hardest question of all. What do we do? And I don't have an answer for that, except the following. Go home, and every morning you wake up, look in the mirror and say, are you doing everything you can to promote active citizenship? Because that is the only way we're going to cure this disease. Active citizenship by every American out there. It doesn't mean that they're going to agree with particular political ideology. I consider myself an active citizen. And I guarantee you that if we sat down across the table and started discussing, you know, our opinion on certain policies, we would disagree. But disagreement's healthy. It's great. You know, when you look at the birth of our country, Thomas Jefferson was sort of the radical progressive liberal of his time. John Adams was sort of the raving, you know, Ann Coulter type right winger. And they didn't agree on anything. Thomas Jefferson had gotten his way on everything he wanted, we wouldn't have the United States of America. The same thing if John Adams had gotten away with everything. But the two didn't. They had to come together. They negotiated, they debated, they fought, they struggled. And the compromises they struck, although not perfect, made this country a better place. That's citizenship. And what we need are Americans to become good citizens, to have the courage to sit down and confront one another about the issues, to get informed, to empower themselves with knowledge and information so that they cannot be intimidated by fear and ignorance. Be good citizens, ladies and gentlemen. Be good citizens, cure the disease, and help make this country live up to the wonderful potential that is found in the words of the Constitution of the United States. We, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union. let's start working on making that union more perfect. Thank you very much.
My name is Hop Hopkins, and I'm part of People of Color Against Globalization. And this is our second event, and we're so happy to have Karen and Scott here. And I'd just like to say that we are a small network of people of color from various ethnic and cultural backgrounds who've taken up this charge to go out and educate ourselves and to educate our community, specifically communities of color, which we come from, that we feel a great deal of responsibility to. And while this plate's going around, I'm going to say a couple things. And the first thing I just want to say is that we, the people of this country, has always excluded and always been a tool to oppress people of color here in this country. So we recognize the shallow promise that is. And we try to go out and educate ourselves initially and our communities about the ills of globalization, imperialism, and colonization, because our people have experienced those things. And we feel as though what Scott is talking about and what's happening around the world, particularly as this country exploits many different parts of the world, and this last illegal invasion taking place in Iraq and in Afghanistan, is just another manifestation of how this country views people, particularly people of color, oppressing them here in this country and taking that oppression and exporting it all across the globe. So that's the one thing I want to say about that just as people of color here, we recognize that we the people and how that tool's been used to oppress us here and how we're watching it oppress other people around the world. All right, so if folks have questions or comments, if you could speak loud enough so the folks on the mic can pick it up and Scott can hear your questions.
What I wanted you to respond to was the idea of all troops out now and how you see that happening, because when I talk to my family members who are totally against the war, they really feel now that we have to stay in to make things okay now. So I'd like to have you respond to that.
Well, this is a no-brainer. A, we don't belong there. So how in the world could you possibly say that we have a right to continue to stay there? Forget the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party never constituted a threat to the people of the United States of America worthy the intervention of American troops. I'm not saying the Ba'ath Party is a good organization. But the idea that we're going to bring democracy to Iraq is absurd in the extreme. You have to deal with foundations. We went into this war on false pretense. This war was never built on something solid. It's a violation of international law. Our continued occupation is a violation of international law. The situation's getting worse, not better. We are not going to win. So how long do your family members want American troops to die in Iraq? The question I ask them is, how big do you want the Iraq War Memorial to be? Where are their brains? And I don't mean to be insulting, but hey, I don't give a damn about their feelings. American boys and girls are dying, and they're killing Iraqi boys and girls. How big do we want the memorial to be? You know, in 1967, when many people recognized that Vietnam was a lost cause, a lot of people said we have to stay the course, keep the boys in there, reinforce, because we got to prevail. Well, we're not going to prevail in Iraq, and we didn't prevail in Vietnam. Imagine how small that black granite V carved into the ground in Washington, D.C. would be if people had said, hey, in 1968, we're getting out of this thing. We can't win. Or in 69, or in 70. You cut 1 year off that war. How many thousands of lives did you save? How big do you want the war memorial in Iraq to be? Because that's the only question that's there right now. The Ba'ath Party, we didn't defeat them. They're still there. How many people here think Saddam Hussein surrendered? Where's the great surrender of the Iraqi army? Where's the surrender of the Iraqi intelligence services? Where's the surrender of the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard? They didn't surrender. They simply melted away. They're still there. They're still resisting, and they're going to continue to resist. We've given a false promise, a false hope of democracy. But democracy, do we want democracy in Iraq? Really? If we had free vote in Iraq, 60% of the population who are Shia Muslim would vote for the installation of an Islamic Republic in Iraq right now. Donald Rumsfeld, who apparently is running the policy in Iraq, has said there will never be an Islamic Republic in Iraq. The Coalition Provisional Authority that's writing the fundamental law for Iraq is struggling against allowing Islam as the official religion of a Muslim country. We don't want democracy in Iraq. We want American-imposed hegemony, stability. And at the end of the day, the only stability that's going to come in Iraq is at the hands of the Sunni, i.e. the Baathists. So we kicked the Baathists out. But you know what we're doing right now? We're scrambling to get the Baathists back in. We demobilized the Baathist military, and now we see that there's no way to get a military up and running without going back to the Baathist troops. We got rid of 3 million Baathists who ran the country for 30 years, and now the country's not functioning. So we're bending over backwards to bring them back in. We're just going to call them something different than the Baathists. Why the hell did we go to war in Iraq to begin with? It's not about democracy. We're not going to win. We've already lost this war. It's just a question of how many troops we're going to lose before we realize this is a war that we cannot win and we bring the troops home. So, confronted with the inevitability of the eventual return of American troops without achieving fundamental victory in Iraq, I say, why wait? Bring the troops home now.
We're now going to hear from a friend of mine and just this, a wonderful, wonderful performer, cultural activist named Olga Garcia, who's a community poet from East Los Angeles, who's been an educator for the past 10 years. And among Latinos for a long time, before we had any kind of written history, we often recorded our history and recorded our stories in either song or in spoken word. And Olga has continued and expanded on that tradition to tell, I think, some incredibly important stories about our reality, about our struggles, about our aspirations. And I'm really pleased that she's here with us tonight to share this special gift. Olga Garcia.
Just want to thank Bill Gallegos for inviting me here tonight. And I think that the arts, poetry, music, and visual art is embedded in the movement, and I think it's important to continue to share our art and for it to be political art and to try to reach as many people as we can through all of the avenues that we have. I'm going to share a poem today. It doesn't have a title. If anybody at the end of the event has a title for me, I would be more than happy to take suggestions. And this is a poem that I wrote after September 11th, about a year after September 11th, and I think during that whole time period, immediately after September 11th, like so many people, so many other people, it was just so overwhelming, and I was so angry about so many things that were happening, and the reactions, the emotional reactions from people and from in my workplace. I remember having flags put on my desk at work and being really upset about that, and just feeling that sense of censorship, not being able to really express yourself or say anything because people would automatically, you know, you were a terrorist, etc. And it took me a long time to write this poem because I was so upset about it, but in many ways I feel that it was something I needed to put down on paper. Today, I do not want my words to be bullets. My language will not be another weapon in warfare. My metaphors, angry as they may be, will not fly like grenades or explode like bright-colored cluster bombs. I, unlike my government, do not own or harbor weapons of mass destruction. I have no quest for the conquest of oil. Truth be told, I would rather be writing a poem about my grandmother planting seeds. I would rather be describing the red wing flower of my lover's embrace. I would rather be nostalgically searching for the missing syllables of my father in a haiku. Honestly, this bruised face of a poem did not want to be born into the 21st century. Not like this, not again. This is an old poem resurfacing like repressed memories, recalling this country's land soaked and drenched in Indian blood. This is such an old poem pointing to the thick scars of African bodies hanging and swaying on the branches of American trees. This is language Langston Hughes's poem declaring America was never America to me. This is a poem that has witnessed Chinese exclusion, Japanese internment, Operation Wetback. This is an old poem that has not forgotten the seemingly forgotten names of Vietnam, Nicaragua, Grenada, the Philippines, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, Afghanistan. This is an old poem that has witnessed bullets entering bodies of 13-year-old boys, throwing stones at military tanks in occupied territories. This is a poem recording the history of bulldozers crumbling homes and crushing skulls in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, recording the history of unlawful incarceration, secret deportations, the building of a Hooked on Fear TV nation. This is an old poem that has seen First World bullies threaten to ambush with ammunition, bombshells, fighter jets, rhetoric of terror to terrorize. You see, this is such an old poem. It's almost a cliche. And I would rather be sitting at the mouth of an ocean talking to the ghost of Storni, meditating on the verses of Gandhi. But I am vomiting this splintered song of a poem, trapped like a tangled scream in my throat, split open and raw in the chest. This is an imperative response to a plague. Violence, violence, violence will not silence this poem, surfacing like a prayer, surfacing like corpses in rivers and deserts, surfacing like wooden crosses, unmarked symbols for the dead. This is a poem standing in protest among arrogant stallions riding into another century, waving loaded guns, tomahawk missiles in the air. We have been here before. This is an old poem. A poem in mourning, in weeping over blood-stained flags, body bags for the few, mass graves for the many. The ghosts of the unnamed are gathering like a sandstorm in this poem. This is a poem in protest, in non-cooperation with the profiteers of war, in protest of pandemic propaganda, in protest of pipelines over people, in protest of patriotism that ignores the growing piles of bodies, men, women, and children whose names have not yet been pronounced. The post-traumatic war syndromes will not be televised. This is a poem in protest against pep rallies for battle, in protest of clapping hands, cheering voices on the sidelines. War is not a football game. This is not a cowboy movie. Iraq is not a video game. This is a poem in protest of euphemisms and non sequiturs. Just for the record, the emperor is not wearing new clothes. War is an intentional act of terrorism. Feeding a population you've purposefully starved and crippled does not make you a humanitarian. It makes you a hypocrite. This poem will not carry banners for conquest, Operation Just Cause, Operation Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom are hereby renamed Operation Corporate Greed, Operation Genocide, Operation Hegemony. Today, I do not want my words to be bullets. My language will not be another weapon in warfare. Today, I want my words to be more courageous than war. I want them to be obsidian mirrors, resilient blades of grass in the wind, a seed for change, an eye that speaks, a match that burns, a fist full of flowers held up to the sky in defiance of death and destruction. Thank you very much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. You can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.
And that was the voice of Dave Adelson of the LA Sound Posse. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. One of the most glaring symptoms of the disease of oligarchy, which Scott Ritter just spoke about, is the rapidly widening gap in wealth in American society. This problem has grown too large for even the corporate press to ignore, and articles in a variety of publications have addressed this. Paul Krugman took on this cherished American myth in an article titled "The Death of Horatio Alger" that appeared last month in The Nation.
The other day, I found myself reading a leftist rag that made outrageous claims about America. It said that we are becoming a society in which the poor tend to stay poor, no matter how hard they work, in which sons are much more likely to inherit the socioeconomic status of their father than they were a generation ago. The name of that leftist rag? Business Week, which published an article entitled "Waking Up from the American Dream." The article summarizes recent research showing that social mobility in the United States, which was never as high as legend had it, had declined considerably over the past few decades. If you put that research together with other research that shows a drastic increase in income and wealth inequality, you reach an uncomfortable conclusion. America looks more and more like a class-ridden society. And guess what? Our political leaders are doing everything they can to fortify class inequality, while denouncing anyone who complains, or even points out what is happening, as a practitioner of class warfare. Let's talk first about the facts on income distribution. 30 years ago, we were a relatively middle-class nation. It had not always been thus. Gilded Age America was a highly unequal society, and it stayed that way through the 1920s. During the 30s and 40s, however, America experienced what the economic historians Claudia Golden and Robert Margot have dubbed the Great Compression, a drastic narrowing of income gaps, probably as a result of New Deal policies. And the new economic order persisted for more than a generation. Strong unions, taxes on inherited wealth, corporate profits and high incomes, close public scrutiny of corporate management, all helped to keep income gaps relatively small. The economy was hardly egalitarian, but a generation ago, the gross inequalities of the 1920s seemed very distant. Now they're back. Now they're back. According to estimates by the economists Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, confirmed by data from the Congressional Budget Office, between 1973 and 2000, the average real income of the bottom 90% of American taxpayers actually fell by 7%. Meanwhile, the income of the top 1% rose by 148%. The income of the top 0.1% rose by 343%, and the income of the top 0.01% rose by 599%. Those numbers exclude capital gains, so they're not an artifact of the stock market bubble. The distribution of income in the United States has gone right back to Gilded Age levels of inequality. Never mind, say the apologists, who churn out papers with titles like that of a 2001 Heritage Foundation piece, "Income Mobility and the Fallacy of Class Warfare Arguments." America, they say, isn't a caste society. People with high incomes this year may have low incomes next year, and vice versa, and the route to wealth is open to all. That's where those commies at Business Week come in. As they point out, and as economists and sociologists have been pointing out for some time, America is actually more of a caste society than we like to think, and the caste lines have lately become a lot more rigid. The myth of income mobility has always exceeded the reality. As a general rule, once they've reached their 30s, people don't move up or down the income ladder very much. Conservatives often cite studies like a 1992 report by Glenn Hubbard, a Treasury official under the elder Bush who later became chief economic advisor to the younger Bush, that purport to show large numbers of Americans moving from low-wage to high-wage jobs during their working lives. But what these studies measure, as the economist Kevin Murphy put it, is mainly, quote, the guy who works in the college bookstore and has a real job by his early 30s, end quote. Serious studies that exclude this sort of pseudo-mobility show that inequality in average incomes over long periods isn't much smaller than inequality in annual income. It is true, however, that America was once a place of substantial intergenerational mobility. Sons often did much better than their fathers. A classic 1978 survey found that among adult men whose fathers were in the bottom 25% of the population as ranked by social and economic status, 23% had made it into the top 25%. In other words, during the first 30 years or so after World War II, the American dream of upward mobility was a real experience for many people. Now for the shocker. The Businessweek piece cites a new survey of today's adult men, which finds that this number has dropped to only 10%. That is, over the past generation, upward mobility has fallen drastically. Very few children of the lower class are making their way to even moderate affluence. This goes along with other studies indicating that rags-to-riches stories have become vanishingly rare, and that the correlation between fathers' and sons' incomes has risen in recent decades. In modern America, it seems, you're quite likely to stay in the social and economic class into which you were born. Businessweek attributes this to the Walmartization of the economy, the proliferation of dead-end, low-wage jobs, and the disappearance of jobs that provide entry to the middle class. That's surely part of the explanation, but public policy plays a role, and will, if present trends continue, play an even bigger role in the future. Put it this way, suppose that you actually liked a caste society, and you were seeking ways to use your control of the government to further entrench the advantages of the haves against the have-nots. What would you do? One thing you would definitely do is get rid of the estate tax, so that large fortunes can be passed on to the next generation. More broadly, you would seek to reduce tax rates both on corporate profits and on unearned income such as dividends and capital gains, so that those with large accumulated or inherited wealth could more easily accumulate even more. You'd also try to create tax shelters, mainly useful for the rich. And more broadly still, you'd try to reduce tax rates on people with high incomes, shifting the burden to the payroll tax and other revenue sources that bear most heavily on people with lower incomes. Meanwhile, on the spending side, you'd cut back on health care for the poor, on the quality of public education, and on state aid for higher education. This would make it more difficult for people with low incomes to climb out of their difficulties and acquire the education essential to upward mobility in the modern economy. And just to close off as many routes to upward mobility as possible, you'd do everything possible to break the power of unions, and you'd privatize government functions so that well-paid civil servants could be replaced with poorly paid private employees. It all sounds sort of familiar, doesn't it? Where is this taking us? Thomas Piketty, whose work with size has transformed our understanding of income distribution, warns that current policies will eventually create a class of rentiers in the U.S., whereby a small group of wealthy but untalented children controls vast segments of the U.S. economy, and penniless, talented children simply can't compete. If he's right, and I fear that he is, we will end up suffering not only from injustice, but from a vast waste of human potential. Goodbye, Horatio Alger, and goodbye, American Dream.
And that was an article by Paul Krugman called The Death of Horatio Alger, published in December in The Nation. Thanks to Chris Sturr for reading it. On December 24th, Reuters News Service also touched on the issue of disappearing opportunity in an article titled U.S. Companies Moving More Jobs Overseas, written by David Zeilenziger. The article said, U.S. corporations are picking up the pace in shifting well-paid technology jobs to India, China, and other low-cost centers. but they are keeping quiet for fear of a backlash, industry professionals said. Morgan Stanley estimates the number of U.S. jobs outsourced to India will double to about 150,000 in the next 3 years. Analysts predict as many as 2 million U.S. white-collar jobs, such as programmers, software engineers, and applications designers, will shift to low-cost centers by 2014. But the biggest companies looking to offshoring to cut costs, such as Microsoft Corp, International Business Machines, and AT&T Wireless, are reluctant to attract attention for political reasons, observers said this week. The problem is that companies aren't sure if it's politically correct to talk about it, said Jack Trout, a principal of Trout & Partners, a marketing and strategy firm. Nobody has come up with a way to spin it in a positive way. This causes a problem for publicly traded companies, which would ordinarily brag about cost savings to investors. Instead, they send vague signals that they are opening up operations in India and China, but often decline to elaborate. Moreover, on the threshold of a U.S. presidential election year, job losses are a hot-button issue. A company that highlighted a major job transfer could wind up in the campaign debate. Multinationals find that when they trumpet expansion overseas, they cause problems at home. When Accenture Limited executives in India this month announced plans to double their staff to 10,000 next year, they triggered a flood of calls to the company's U.S. offices about U.S. job losses. Offshoring companies, quote, are paying Chinese wages and selling at U.S. prices, unquote, said Alan Tonelson of the U.S. Business and Industrial Council, a trade group for small business. They're not creating better living standards for America. The U.S. sales director of one of India's top computer service providers said his company has won business from customers such as Walt Disney Company, Time Warner Inc.'s CNN, and the Fox division of News Corp., none of which want public disclosure. Oh, I'm sorry, I have to repeat this again. The U.S. sales director for one of India's top computer services providers said his company has won business from customers such as Walt Disney Company, Time Warner's CNN, and the Fox division of News Corp., none of which want public disclosure. In India, some technology companies have recently adopted lower profiles. Microsoft Corp. has been removing its name from minibuses used to ferry engineers on overnight shifts. Major Indian beneficiaries of U.S. business such as Infosys Technologies Limited, Wipro Limited, and Satyam Computer Services Limited have stopped identifying new customers. While there have been reports that IBM intends to ship 4,700 high-end jobs to India and China next year, they mark a rare instance when figures have been reported in black and white, said Linda Geyer, president of Alliance at IBM, a union that has tried to organize IBM employees. Those numbers were not released by IBM, but rather disclosed by the Wall Street Journal, which had obtained an internal memo. The company has declined to comment. Geyer believes as many as 40,000 of IBM's 160,000 U.S. jobs will be transferred overseas by 2005, a figure, she says, was gathered from phone calls by IBM employees. Previously, IBM has pointed to a report by the McKinsey Global Institute that concludes that the U.S. economy ultimately will benefit. The report was commissioned by NASSCOM, a group made up of Indian tech companies as well as IBM's Indian Services Unit, showing an effort by those invested in offshoring to sway public opinion. Recently, AT&T Wireless told the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that it would lay off 1,900 employees this year. Communications Workers of America members obtained an internal memo produced by Tata Consulting Services of India that discussed how it would assume those U.S. jobs. Subsequently, AT&T wireless officials acknowledged it was exploring the job shifts, but didn't offer details. While some companies, such as Electronic Data Systems Corp., CAP, Gemini, Ernst & Young, and Sapient Corp. acknowledge they shift jobs abroad to exploit cost advantages and around-the-clock work, IBM asserts that it is not moving jobs, but creating new ones. It's a business strategy, period. You cut costs. You revamp. You look at what your mission statement says and try to turn a profit, said Sylvia Thomas, who was laid off by chipmaker Agure Systems after declining offers to relocate to headquarters in Allentown, Pennsylvania, or to Singapore. And that was from the Reuters News Service, December 24, 2003, U.S. Companies Moving More Jobs Overseas, by David Zeilenziger. We'll conclude the program with the next installment of our ongoing reading of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, by Jeff Schmidt. This week, we'll begin Chapter 8, titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum. All I want to do now is make some big bucks, a physics graduate student told me as he neared completion of his PhD and was starting to look for a job. He knew this simple statement said a lot about how his goals had changed during graduate school. While he may not have even clearly remembered his original intellectual interests or his original degree of determination that his work be of benefit to society, he did realize that somewhere along the way he had become very flexible in these personal and social goals. Listening to him, I could see that he sought big bucks, not as payment for valuable skills that he would put at his employer's disposal, but as compensation for intellectual interests and social goals abandoned. Once the student abandons his own agenda, his course is set. And before long, he is working like the physicist described in Chapter 4 and 5, as if the agenda of the dominant sector of society were his own. How does the professional physicist come to abandon his own agenda and adopt an outlook that is appropriate for what physicists actually do in this society? This chapter looks at the steps. Most people, including leftists, do not think of professional training as changing people. They think of it as simply teaching people facts and skills. Anyone holding this static view of the individual will not be able to explain why professional education is the way it is, or why professionals are the way they are. Those who run professional training programs certainly take a dynamic view of the individual, and we should too, if we want to understand how they make professionals. And the first subcaption is titled, Before the Narrowing. The outlook of students completing professional training programs is markedly different from that of students entering them. By professional training programs, I mean traditional professional school as well as graduate PhD programs. While the new professionals emerge from training somewhat more conservative on average than they were when they entered, the most striking difference is that they show less diversity in their attitudes, their views of the world, the nature of their intellectual interests, the roles they see for themselves in society, the roles they think their chosen field should play in society, and their goals for society itself. The student beginning professional training is usually highly optimistic about the opportunity for an intellectually rewarding and socially beneficial career. This is certainly the case in physics, where the beginning graduate students see the kind of work physicists do as research on intriguing fundamental questions aimed at furthering human understanding of the universe, leading sooner or later to socially beneficial technology. The student enthusiastically anticipates doing creative work in this quest for seemingly eternal truth. Moreover, both the economy and the culture respect the scientist and uphold the notions that the scientist's professional work is objective, politically neutral, and universal in content. Thus, the beginning student sees the possibility for a rare combination: career work that is intellectually, materially, and socially rewarding, and that is free of political direction or interference. The expectation of political freedom follows from the student's faith that the search for truth transcends even the most serious earthly struggles for social power. The student outside the sciences anticipates the same rewards and freedom, expecting the professional status will bring autonomy in the workplace and a career free from domination by any powerful hierarchy. If students are overly upbeat about what becoming a professional can do for the individual and for society, that is not because they are naive, although naivete makes this possible. Rather, they are searching with some urgency to find a way to achieve their personal and social goals. Students are well aware that in a hierarchical society, one does not automatically get to live a life with any significant independence from management and its monitoring and control of the details of work, and even of some leisure activity. Students beginning professional training are not properly aware, however, that there is a price to pay for any independence gained by becoming a professional. A look at those who have paid the price, students emerging from professional training, gives a hint as to what the price is. Students finishing the ordeal of professional training often appear to be pressured and troubled, as if under some sort of unrelenting duress whose source they can't pinpoint. Anyone who has been around a university graduate student department or other professional school has undoubtedly seen many such students. These students end up doing much of their work while in a state of physical and mental fatigue, precluding the creativity and enjoyment that were once their priority. They are no longer the upbeat students who entered the professional training program. Students who were adamant about not wanting to become cogs in the machine, students who would join the system only on their own terms, students who stood solidly behind their own goals for society. Many of these students now have a tired, defeated look about them and an outlook to match. Many are now quite willing to incorporate themselves into one or another hierarchy and to put up no resistance there, overt or covert, as they help do the work that furthers their new employer's goals. The willingness shown by the new graduate to function harmoniously with the system is usually not the disingenuous kind shown by people who have their fundamental reservations, but who are reluctantly going along with the only choice available. The new graduate often feigns reluctance so as to maintain appearances, but it is usually painfully obvious that deep down something has changed. The individual has taken a step toward adopting the worldview of the system and goals compatible with the system. Students who once spoke critically of the system are now either silent or fearfully fair and responsible in their criticism. They are careful not to be provocative, not to do or say anything that might displease individuals in authority. Any opposition is now sufficiently abstract and theoretical to not be provocative. Don't assume that behavior motivated by fear is disingenuous. It usually isn't, because the safest way to behave in a way that will please the powerful is to do so genuinely. The most blatant examples are cases of the Stockholm Syndrome, named for a 1973 incident in which hostages taken during a bank robbery in Sweden grew to identify with their captors. Although the professional has sidelined his original goals, he usually retains some memory of them. Any such memory inevitably points to the compromises he's made, and therefore can be an unrecognized source of unease in the professional's life. None of this is to imply that new professionals are left without goals. Ironically, the primary goal for many becomes, in essence, getting compensated sufficiently for sidelining their original goals. Robert H. Frank, a Cornell University economics professor, tried to find out exactly how much compensation people deem sufficient for making this sacrifice. He surveyed graduating seniors at his university and found, for example, that the typical student would rather work as an advertising copywriter for the American Cancer Society than as an advertising copywriter for Camel cigarettes, and would want a salary 50% higher to do it for the cigarette company. The typical student would want conscience money amounting to a 17% salary boost to work as an accountant for a large petrochemical company instead of doing the same job for a large art museum. Indeed, employers that are seen as less socially responsible do have to pay a moral reservation premium to get the workers they want. Frank found that men are more likely than women to sell out, and this accounts for at least part of the gap in average salaries between equal men and women. Once the professional adopts this new quantitative measure of success, the system has him in the palm of its hand, for he maximizes his compensation by working hard to further the goals of his employer, and thus the system. And work hard he does. 12-hour or longer workdays are standard for many young professionals. According to the Wall Street Journal, in some investment banking and law firms, 7-day, 100-hour work weeks aren't uncommon. At First Boston Corporation, a large international investment banking firm headquartered in New York City, young associates stay late about 3 nights a week. Other nights, they're out by 8 or 9, the chairman of the corporation's recruiting committee tells the journal. Moreover, in spite of his marathon effort and to his employer's further delight, the young professional feels that he must not be working hard enough because the compensation never quite seems to satisfy him. The feeling of having it all eludes him. In fact, his efforts are futile, for no amount of income or status can make a whole social being who has abandoned his own intellectual and political goals. The situation tends to be self-perpetuating. The professional's priority on compensation inhibits him from developing and pursuing his own intellectual and political goals, because the independent thinking necessary to do that is incompatible with the mindset necessary to do the best for his employers, and therefore to do the best in the rat race. Furthermore, the rat race is an all-encompassing effort. The young professional works the week like a sprint and is left with only a few hours of leisure time out of the week's 168 hours. To prepare his mind adequately for the professional work ahead, he must spend his hard-won free time working at relaxation, certainly not reflecting. Until the professional assigns highest importance to developing and advancing his own political goals, serving the system will not be just his job, but his life. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Going on to the next subsection of Chapter 8, which is titled Metamorphosis and Unnatural Selection. There are only two conceivable mechanisms by which those completing professional training can come to be different in outlook from those beginning it. Ideological weeding out and ideological transformation. Both mechanisms, elimination and assimilation, operate at every step in the production of the professional. In physics, about half of the students who enter PhD programs leave without the degree, many due to outright expulsion. This massive elimination allows the political biases in the weeding out process to have a strong effect on the overall political nature of the graduating class. Adjustment works hand in glove with this elimination, informing the class politically. Many of those who survive the weeding out do so by shaping up under the threat of being culled, and in the process undergo attitudinal transformations that make them politically compatible with the others who are not weeded out. Professional physicists are produced in 5 steps: admission, courses, qualification, research, and employment. The weeding out and transformation at each step shape the character of the final product, the annual crop of new physicists. In admission, there is a small amount of weeding out and very little transformation. The large majority of applicants to physics PhD programs gain admission, and they don't have to go through many changes to do so. In courses, there is a further weeding out, and transformation gains in importance. Qualification is the step at which the system decides officially whether or not the student may, in principle, become a professional in his chosen field. It is around this stage that most of the elimination and adjustment occurs. In the student research project, there is further transformation, but only a small amount of weeding out, as few leave the field. Finally, in employment, a small amount of adjustment is often necessary, and there is also further weeding out, as some graduates never get jobs in the field. This series of steps is fairly standard for all professions whose members are a product of graduate training. The amount of weeding out and transformation at each stage of training varies from field to field and from school to school, but the basic program is the same. Although training for the traditional professions is structured somewhat differently, qualification remains the crucial step. As I discussed in the previous chapter, qualification in medicine is early, at admission to medical school. Accordingly, both transformation and weeding out operate at full force. The admission process engenders the infamous self-centered competitive outlook of the pre-med student and involves a high percentage of rejections. Because my main example is physics, I focus on the elements of professional training in graduate school, which is where physicists are trained, and I leave it to the interested reader to identify the corresponding elements of training in traditional professional school. Critics of education and the professions have paid very little attention to the step of qualification, even though this is where students either get the green light for careers in their chosen professions or have their hopes for such careers reduced to fantasies. The critics evidently do not see the heart of the selective system as favoring students with particular attitudes and outlooks. The critics' silence on the issue reveals the unspoken assumption that they share with the system. Qualifying is mainly a matter of meeting basic standards. The qualification process is a nonpartisan evaluation of whether or not the student is good enough to become a professional in a particular field. The question of whether or not the student qualifies is prior to any question of ideology. All questions of ideology aside, some candidates, and in some fields evidently, most of the candidates, just don't have the right stuff to be professionals. So qualifying is a more personal matter than a political one. Even leftist critics of education and the professions can often be heard using the rhetoric of personal merit in informal conversation. Consider the difference between asking a student who recently took the qualifying examination, "Did you pass?" and asking the student, "Did they pass you?" These two questions reflect vastly different outlooks. People often say, "Congratulations on passing," in a way that implies, "You've shown you've got what it takes." Or they say, "I'm sorry you didn't make it," while resolving to themselves never again to mention what they consider to be a personal failure. They make the subject awkward and embarrassing by viewing it as a question of individual merit. Their focus on the student, not on the examiners, announces their general acceptance of the examiner's criteria for selection. When the issue is how good the student is, there is no criticism of what the examiners are looking for, and nothing is exposed about the true nature of the field that the selection system functions to reproduce. Every professional training program reinforces the unspoken assumption listed above by presenting its process of qualification as an unbiased assessment of the student's aptitude in the field. The central element of this assessment is the qualifying examination. This examination, which I maintain is far from neutral politically, is the centerpiece of the selection system because, ironically, as a technical test, it gives the selection system its image of neutrality. But the qualifying examination is part of the selection system not just to give that system an ideologically unbiased look. The examination is also an important part of the mechanism by which the selection system imposes its ideology. In fact, the qualifying examination is the keystone of the ideologically biased process of weeding and transformation. It serves simultaneously as an imposed objective, disciplining student goals toward the norm, and as a measure, revealing the student's degree of orientation toward that norm. I will discuss each step in the production of the professional physicist, focusing on qualification. Disillusionment can strike the student at any step in the process. In the example here, it hits late in the game, during research. And we're out of time for the program this week. Next week, we'll continue with more reading from Chapter 8 of Disciplined Minds, Narrowing the Political Spectrum. Disciplined Minds was published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield, and Jeff Schmidt, who has a PhD in physics and also worked as a writer and editor for 19 years for Physics Today, was fired from his job after publishing the book. There's a campaign to help him get his job back, which you can read about and participate in by going to his website at disciplinedminds.com. And if you'd like more information on this program, on welcome guests, to contact us, or to download copies of previous programs you may have missed, visit our website at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.